Well, as has been pointed out, we've reached at long last the final chapter of Deuteronomy. Pat yourself on the back, you made it. And I looked up when we started, and Shahay made us agree with this, but my records show July 26th of last year. So I think we covered Deuteronomy in less than a year, which is kind of impressive. And on another note, we started the Torah, the first five books, of course, back in June 2011. So we've been working on that for a while. And Deuteronomy concludes, obviously, the book of Deuteronomy, but also the Torah. And it's, I think, a milestone in our congregational history that we've worked our way through the five books of the Old Testament. I thought we should mention Taylor and Rachel and Rose tonight. Miss Taylor and his comments and how much he assisted in our study. I wish he was here tonight to see this conclusion. Well, Moses has reached the end of his earthly life, and it's not his last biblical appearance, though. You might think, well, that's it. Moses is done. But as Brother Jerry Dickinson taught us, he shows up in Luke chapter 9 in the Transfiguration. So he's not through. It's like there's a stage call, and Moses comes back on. Doesn't say anything, but he shows up once again in the scripture. God finishes, we've noticed before, God finishes in this chapter what he started back in Exodus chapter 4. God came to kill Moses at the encampment in Exodus 4, and Zipporah saved him. But God is now going to finish the job, and Moses is going to die. And of course, that is God's right to kill Moses, end Moses' life, as he does with each of us. Well, without further ado, let us begin the chapter. And question one is, how could Moses see all the lands described in these verses when some of them were many miles from Mount Nebo? Wes.
So Moses he goes up to Mount Nebo, and these verses say that he could see this large distance. Some scholars say in ancient times, the person who was purchasing the land surveyed it. And so they would look at their land in order to take possession of it. And that possibly God is allowing Moses to go up and take possession of the land that he won't be able to enter, but he's the surveyor of the land. The question says, how could he see these many miles? The simple answer is, it says the Lord showed him all the land and caused him to see it with his eyes. And so whether he could physically see it from that vantage point or if there was some supernatural, miraculous vision that he was given, we don't know. There are disagreements. Kaufman notes several sides of this. Some people saying the whole prospect could not have been surveyed by any ordinary power. Moses' vision was miraculously increased. Others say no miracle was required, and certain travelers have gone up Mount Nebo, and they've looked, and they can see from Mount Hermon to the Mediterranean, and they say this wasn't a supernatural event. Others say it's impossible, there's no way, and this was supernatural. Ultimately, I don't think it really matters, because it tells us that God showed him, and it specifically says he caused him to see it with his eyes. And so what we know is that Moses did see all the way.
Yes, Bill.
Yeah, I was reminded of Matthew chapter 4 when the devil took Jesus up and somehow, you know, Jesus was able to see, I think it said all the kingdoms of the world. So I think supernatural, but.
Yes. Other comments on this particular event? Shy.
Well, obviously there's the view that the sites that are listed are just meant to be representative of the general areas that Moses saw. Not necessarily that, as later texts would say, he saw from Dan to Beersheba. Not necessarily that, but simply that he saw the general area of the land. I don't think that's right. I think that there is something miraculous happening here. In fact, in the expression, the Lord showed him all the land, the verb is in a particular form called the hifil form. And so it could literally be translated as Wes mentioned, the Lord caused him to see. And this verbal form is often used to describe God doing something miraculous. Showing something to someone in a vision, for example. We see examples of this in Exodus 33:18 and in Deuteronomy 3:24. So I think somehow God gave Moses some miraculous binoculars and amplified his vision either through a dreamlike vision or some other means so that he could fulfill, as Wes said, the full survey of the land that the people were about to inherit. And I also just thought I'd mention that there's obviously a strong parallel here between what is described of Moses and what God said to Abraham. When Abraham first came into the promised land in Genesis 13, verses 14 through 17, God said, look north, look east, look west, look all around, everything you can see. Maybe God was amplifying Abraham's vision as well. All of this I'm going to give to your descendants. And then in verse 4 of our text, that connection is made explicit when it's mentioned that the Lord had told Abraham and all the patriarchs that this land would be given to them. And so God, at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, is coming back full circle to the initial progress and promise that was made through Abraham many hundreds of years earlier.
Very good. Any other comments? Go backwards here. I wanted to show this map, which shows Mount Nebo or Pisgah, and looking across 20 miles to Jericho. 10 miles to Jericho, I believe. 20 miles to Jerusalem. And probably there would have been more of the Dead Sea before it dried up between the two. This is the same location, apparently, that at least Balaam gave part of his. Remember, Balaam went up mountain there in Moab and tried to curse Israel. And at the top of Pisgah, he gave his second oracle where he blessed Israel. This may have been the same location. Nobody knows, of course, for sure. Here's a map of the area. From Gilead up in this region to Zoar, and here's Mount Nebo. It's 100 miles from Mount Nebo all the way up to Dan, and that's a long way to see with the physical eye. I'm sure the outdoors guys know that that's not possible with the with normal vision. It's not possible to see 100 miles, even on the clearest of days. And Moses saw Naphtali, which really is the Sea of Galilee, that area, Ephraim, Judah, the Mediterranean Sea coast, Jericho, which is 10 miles, Zoar, which is 65. What's interesting, it just suddenly occurred to me that Jerusalem is not mentioned here, the city of the Jebusites, because it was said that this place the Lord will set up his temple will be the place that you go to worship. It had yet to be named, and so it's not mentioned, which it's interesting because, of course, that is the most important part. And it could be seen from this location. You can go to Mount Nebo today. Many so-called pilgrims go to Mount Nebo. It's in the country of Jordan. And as you might imagine, it's a tourist trap. Plenty of terrible things to sell you as you go up this mountain. They call it a memorial of Moses, a Christian holy place, they say. And at the very top of Mount Nebo, is this Franciscan monastery, which was built, interestingly, in 1993. It's not very old, and I'm sure they have plenty of knickknacks to sell there. And this, I thought this was the one of the most interesting things. You stand, and you look, and there's this plaque as you look. So you're looking toward the Mediterranean Sea, and then it tells you which direction to look to see the various locations, and it tells you how far. So Jerusalem is 46 kilometers, and you would look a little bit to the left to see Jerusalem. Here it is. Nablus, Jericho is only 10 miles. You would look almost straight ahead for Jericho. So I was interested, could you see any of these sites? And as you might imagine, you Google these images on the internet to see if people actually got any shots of Jerusalem, which is only 20 miles away. And I couldn't find a single shot that I was able to discern Jerusalem. Here's a shot that someone took the Dead Sea, perhaps you can see there. I guess this is probably the Dead Sea. And then this is supposed to be Jerusalem here, and Jericho, which is 10 miles. Maybe that's it. I'm not sure. Sea of Galilee up here. Obviously, it's a kind of hazy day whenever somebody took that photograph. And I couldn't find any that would show any of those places very well. So I agree with the general consensus that it was a miraculous vision that the Lord gave Moses, similar again to what Satan did with the Lord. After 40 days of temptation, the Lord was given a vision of the kingdoms. After 40 years of wandering, Moses was given a vision of the promised lands. Any other comments before we move on to question number two? All right. Question number two then. Why were the people not allowed to bury their leader or even visit his grave, Logan?
The most probable reason is idolatry, for the most part. It's likely, since Moses was such an important leader and he'd led for such a long time, that there'd be a few that would try and worship his bones or treat him as if he was some kind of entity or spiritual being. And today, if anyone knew where he was buried and if he was dug up, there would be people worshiping even today. So that is probably the main reason. Another reason I thought of would be for reverence's sake. Moses' body was used by God to speak to the Israelites. He performed many miracles in his lifetime. And because of that, and because of what that meant, his body was God's, and to God it would return justly.
Very good. Thank you. Other comments on this somewhat mysterious passage here? Yes.
I don't have a comment so much. I'm hoping that the experts in the room can resolve Jude 1:9. Jude 1:9 says, Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. And Jude is using it maybe not even in that direct context. It seems that he's talking about reverence for angels and devils, and it's saying in this case, even when Michael the archangel was having this argument, he still didn't revile the devil. He said the Lord rebuke you. But the illustration is there was this dispute about the body of Moses, and I went down a long wormhole reading different opinions about that, and I just wondered what the brethren think about that.
Maybe Shawhey has a comment. I don't. I, like you, you know, mystified. Several commentators said it was probably about this very issue, that Satan knew that people would make an idol out of Moses' body, and so then there was this contention about it. And very difficult to imagine that, but we're told it happened, so it did. And it, as Logan pointed out, people have the bones of saints everywhere. Even in Colombia, there's Catholic places with the bones of saints that people go and visit, and perhaps worship. They might disagree, but John, comment on Jude.
I think the body of Moses refers to the Jewish people, as Christians are referred to as the body of Christ. And there's a long explanation as to why I think that, which I'm not necessarily prepared to give right now, but I don't think that Satan and Michael were arguing over the corpse of Moses. I think that there was a dispute over the nation of Israel, that there was a fight for control over the nation. And so I think the body of Moses there probably refers to the Jewish people.
Other comments? It's interesting that there is some controversy about who buried the body. This individual, McConville, says that the verb bury could be rendered either active or passive. If the former, God buried him. If the latter, the text is stating that Moses was buried without naming those responsible. And he says the traditional interpretation is that God buried Moses by the ministry of angels. Regardless, no one knew where Moses was buried. I thought that was an interesting point. Yes, Lauren.
I don't want to get into the reason why some of the commentators made some connection with Enoch and Elijah and so forth, and but didn't quite understand it. what they were saying, but I was reading along that same line of connection with Elijah. In Haley's Bible commentary, he talked about the travels of Elijah, and I found this kind of interesting, that, you know, we're talking about where Moses could see from here, and, you know, so Elijah's up on Mount Carmel when the prophets of Baal, but then he travels to Horeb, which is likely Sinai, you know, for the still small voice, and then when the chariots take him up, it talks about him going over the Jordan River, heading back across, which you had been in the same area of Mount Nebo at that time when he was taken up. So, you know, he made that connection of the travels of Elijah, and then also, as you mentioned earlier, about their meeting together on the mountain of Transfiguration, which he suggests is Mount Hermon.
Interesting. Also, another connection with Balaam here, as Jerry says, the prophet for prophet, he went to several locations when he was doing his oracles, and one of the locations was Beth Peor, which is a place of idolatrous worship, and Moses was buried opposite of that. So you might maybe say Moses was diametrically opposed, the opposite of Balaam. Moses was not a prophet for prophet. I don't know if that is intended in the... But it's in a valley in the land of Moab. A lonely gravesite, I'm sure. Not what Moses would have chosen. The last place he wanted to be buried was Moab. All right, let's move on to question 3. Why is the health status of Moses discussed here? Sean?
To reinforce the fact that Moses did not die from old age. He was still vigorous and strong. Rather, he died at God's command, like his brother Aaron back in Numbers 33:38. A lot of commentators make a big deal about this chapter that the reason why Moses is not allowed to cross over is not discussed, as it is in previous chapters. And so they will elaborate on that by saying that Moses dies here because his work is complete. He's done all that he needed to do. He completed the Exodus. He bound the people in the covenant. He delivered the law, and now his job is done, his work is ended, and he can die. I think the reason that Moses the cause for him not being able to enter here is because the book is ending on a positive note. Likely this last chapter was written by Joshua or some other figure in the history of Israel, and so they are very positively stating Moses, the end of Moses' life, and giving him all the credit that he is due. And so the reason that Moses dies is not because his work is finished. The reason Moses dies is not because he was old, 120 years old. The reason Moses dies is because God decided this was going to be the time that he died, and he would not cross over because of his sin. So I want to emphasize that this is not just that Moses' work is complete, but that this is a result of God's decree. Israel mourned, as they did for Aaron, 30 days. And of course, this was fitting for his status as a great leader. And then in verse number 9, we have the mention there of the transfer of authority, which is elaborated on in the first chapter of the book of Joshua, that Joshua succeeds this great man. And interesting here, the mention of Joshua's possession of the spirit of wisdom because of the fact that Moses had laid hands on him. That's a concept I think we generally associate with the New Testament practice of apostles transferring spiritual gifts through the laying on of hands. But this is a concept that dates well back into the ancient times of the Old Testament. And so Moses laid hands on Joshua to inaugurate him, to ordain him, to signify to the people that he was to be the successor, but also in some way to transfer this spirit of wisdom, a quality that Joshua would certainly need. He'd already proven that he could lead soldiers into battle, but more than generaling was required to be a good leader. And so this spirit of wisdom is transferred upon him. Solomon, of course, asked for wisdom. Isaiah promised that a leader in the future would be wise beyond imagination in Isaiah 11 verses 1 through 5. So wisdom was something Joshua needed and something Moses could give him before he passed on.
Yes.
You know those people that go to funerals that have probably never said anything nice about the person that died in their lives and is probably at odds with them for the entire time that they knew them? That's kind of what I thought of. I thought of those people when I saw that Israel mourned and wept for 30 days over Moses. These are the people who have spent the last 40 years of his life making his daily go abouts to be a struggle. I mean, he had to put up with so much for these people, and then now they weep and mourn when he dies. And I just thought about those people. It's like, you know, what did they actually feel that sorrow for the death of Moses, or were they just doing it because?
Yes, Dennis.
I saw it a little bit differently. I was thought immediately back in Exodus 3, verse 12, when Moses spent the entire third chapter and half the fourth trying to get out of this mission. God says, I will certainly be with you. And I think that's encompasses a lot of things other than that immediate circumstances, but it's a short statement, but very powerful. I think he's telling him that he's going to be with him all the way through to the end and make sure he has everything he needs to do this mission. When he had health, it's time for him to go.
Yeah, the Hebrew, and Shahi can correct me if I'm wrong, but his eyes were not dim nor his moisture diminished, which I guess is a Hebrewism for old age. And it is something we see in medicine. Salivary glands sometimes go dry. And people have trouble with that. Other issues like your eyes getting all dry. And so I thought of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and how at least we know for sure that Isaac and Jacob had issues with the vision and couldn't see very well. And obviously, Jacob raised himself up on his bed to bless his 12 sons. And so Moses, in a sense, while he was denied being able to enter into the promised land, he did maintain great vigor until his old age. And so that was it wasn't a bargain he struck, obviously, but you know, definitely being spry enough to climb up Mount Nebo. I would imagine if we went over there now and we were required to climb Mount Nebo, some of us might struggle. So that's pretty good when you're 120. Yes, Wes.
We've mentioned this several times over the last few weeks, but it seems worth reiterating that Moses was also a type of Christ, and that's, I think, shown here and also in what Shai had to say. He was still full of life, and he died because it was God's plan for him to die.
Right. Exactly. Because he struck the rock when he was supposed to speak to him. Other comments before we move on? All right. That brings us to question 4. How is the life and career of Moses summarized?
Well, relatively plainly, there hasn't arisen a prophet like him since, or at the time of the writing. And essentially all the signs and wonders, the mighty power, the great chariot that Moses was a part of are all summarized and referred to in these verses. Essentially, Moses was the founder and the mediator of the Old Covenant. As long as that lasted, there could not be somebody, a greater prophet than him. Now, that Kaufman made a good reference. He said, there was never but one in all human history who indeed a prophet like unto Moses existed, one in the mighty signs and wonders, and his being the mediator of the covenant, who knew directly from God what was indeed the divine will, and who actually led the people out of bondage.
Other comments about the life and the career of Moses?
I found myself trying to imagine, I mean, it's almost like Moses and God could have a conversation, you know, in the Old Path commentary, you know, Jerry wrote about walking with God on the back page. What I think they're still calling it the back page. They talk about walking with God, and Moses walked with God. Can you imagine? Maybe every day being able to have a conversation with the Lord. That almost gives you goosebumps, you know, could give you goosebumps if you really thought about it. And, you know, the miracles, the power, you know, all those things that Hunter alluded to, it's impressive to me.
True. Yes, Lauren.
Like Bill was saying, I think one of the best summaries right there is in verse 10, knew the Lord face to face. And we see that in several other instances. Again, Enoch says he walked with God and he was not. So you know, he's that personal relationship there. And then Israel is commanded later on in Micah to walk humbly with their God. And when, you know, Jesus asked for the greatest commandments, love God with your whole heart and soul.
Yes, Matt.
An important question to ask is why has there not been another prophet like Moses in Israel? And, well, if you know the book of Deuteronomy, you know that chapter 18 says, I will raise up a prophet, or God will raise up a prophet like me to you. Well, who's that talking about? It's talking about Jesus. So there's, no matter when this chapter was written, whether it was written by Joshua or someone later on, it doesn't matter, because before or after that, there will not be a prophet until Jesus comes. And that's, I think that's kind of what this is trying to say there. If you pair that with chapter 18, you see, well, there won't be ever until the Messiah comes.
Very good. Yes, you stole my thunder. That was going to be my point. I think this is pointing more to Christ than that first part of the phrase. If it was written by, I imagine, an elderly Joshua after the conquest, and he's finishing the book of Deuteronomy, and in a humble way, he's saying that no prophet has yet arisen, and we're still looking for the Messiah to come. And the Hebrew writer picks up on that theme, of course, and says that he has come, that prophet has come, and he's greater than Moses in Hebrews chapter 3. Yes, Sean?
I found it interesting that in the speeches Moses gives in this book, much of what he says can be summarized in him trying to prove the incomparable nature, the incomparability of God, that there is no power, there is no God like the God of Israel, the God who created the heavens and the earth. And they'll be tempted to go into idolatry and to worship false statues. But none of those things can compare to the power and wonder of God. And here, Joshua, whoever writes this, really says the same thing about Moses. That as far as prophets go, no one is comparable to Moses. No one had the kind of relationship with the Lord Moses had. No one worked the signs and wonders that Moses could work. And so he was a servant par excellence. He could not be likened to any other who came in his order, as Deuteronomy 18 sort of indicates, that there would be an order of prophets to follow Moses. So whenever this was written, I agree with what you said, that this probably was looking forward as well as backward from the time it was penned, that Moses would stand out in these ways, and that even great men, even great leaders, even great prophets who would follow could not be compared to Moses until the fulfillment of Deuteronomy 18 finally occurred.
Very true. Very good. All right. Let's move on then to question 5. Shahi kind of gives us a great open-ended question here. What are some of the greatest lessons you have learned from Moses? Bill, did you? Yeah, you're next, right?
Yeah, I guess it struggled with it a little bit. His leadership, he was the leader and the lawgiver, you know, for Israel. And in that role, he at different times, boy, did he demonstrate patience, you know, and different times he, you know, the encouragement, I mean, went back to the beginning and was looking at the bullet points through the book, and you know, the time and time again, exhorting Israel to be faithful. I mean, how many times were they warned about idolatry? At a different time, he was willing to sacrifice himself to keep the Lord from destroying the nation and starting over. I mean, those are pretty unique leadership qualities. And just the amazing faith that he had in God.
Very good. Yes, Matt.
What's the first thing that Moses does every time there's an issue, anytime there's an uprising, anytime there's any kind of confrontation? What's the first thing he does? He goes to God, falls on his face, prays to God. The one time he doesn't do that is why he is dying on Mount Nebo and not in the Promised Land. But every other example we have is him doing this. And I think that that's an incredible thing to take away, especially from what we just read of there's not a prophet like Moses. He talked to God face to face. Well, why did he do that? It's because he trusted in God.
Very good. Lauren?
Scripture's kind of saying the same thing. Numbers 12:7, Moses is the most humble man on the face of the earth. 12:8, he's faithful. And in Exodus 32, as Bill was saying, he cared for the people more than he did for himself. He was willing to give his soul for them. And Hebrews 11:23-28, you know, it says that Moses was willing to leave all the glories of Egypt behind to follow Christ, follow God.
Good. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I took it a little bit more personally. I was thinking one lesson that you are capable of doing more in service to God than what you think you can. I thought all the way back to, again, Exodus 4, verse 10, he was described as slow in speech, and he ends up delivering three addresses to Israel that makes up the whole book of Deuteronomy. And with God's help and power, he went from a shepherd with poor speaking skills to a national leader. Powerful order, and he was through God's continual help, he turned a group of Hebrew slaves into a nation. Basically, this humility made him an ideal candidate to be helped by God. It was a great combination.
Good, thank you. It's like trying to summarize scripture. It's very difficult to do. I love how Moses teaches us to seek the place where the Lord your God chooses, a principle that people don't remember, and that's something we strive to do. I love how Moses never loses faith in God, that he administers justice for the fatherless and the widow and loves the stranger, and that's something people challenge in our world all the time, that God is evil and God is wicked. God is not, and Moses loves God and said that he was a gracious God. And of course the Shema, that we are to love the Lord with all our heart, soul, and strength. And finally, Moses points us to Christ. That's in the humility of Christ and how Moses was the most humble, but Jesus is God and came to earth and became a servant. And I like how after 40 days of Moses, after 40 years, gave three speeches. Jesus, after 40 days, responded to three temptations, quoting from Deuteronomy each time. And so, over and over again, Moses is a picture of Christ.
I'd like to add something to that, because I think for me, that's one of the greatest lessons that I've learned from our study of the Old Testament, is how the life and career of Moses helps us to better appreciate and understand the work of Christ. Moses illustrates Christ to us in many ways, and this expression that we saw here about knowing God face to face, I've been thinking a lot about that, and it reminded me of something that I learned a little while ago about John 1. So John 1, verses 1 and 2 says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God." And that word "with," he was in the beginning with God, and the Word was with God. The word "with" comes from a Greek preposition "pros." And "pros," when it's used in this grammatical structure, is a shorthand way of using the noun "prosopone." The word "prosopone" is the word "face." So in the Septuagint, when it says that Moses knew God face to face, it's prosopone, kata, prosopone. Their faces, and I think that speaks to their relationship. In John 1, when it says the Word was with God, the Word was face to face with God, it speaks of the equality the Word has with God. And of course, we know a few verses later in that chapter, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And so the Word that was with God, that was face to face with God, Jesus, incarnated into the flesh, and He dwelt among us. And so He showed us, He showed His disciples and all of Israel what it means to be face to face with God. In other words, Jesus revealed to us what it was like to be Moses, in a sense, because He showed us that face of God, that face to face relationship. So I was really struck by that, the prosopon idea here, that we learn something incredible about Jesus in Moses, and something that we have that none of the Old Testament saints had except for Moses, to see God face to face.
This author here again, he says, it seems in this chapter that God is angry. It almost seems that God is angry with Moses and puts Moses to death. And he says that is another picture of the relationship of Christ being the suffering servant. God strikes Jesus. God punishes the suffering servant. And he says, the line from here, Deuteronomy 34, to the servant of Isaiah's servant songs is clear. I like that idea. Moses is a suffering servant, but he's only a suffering servant in that he points to the true suffering servant, Jesus Christ. Yes, Wes.
This maybe isn't a lesson that I learned specific from Moses, but just through studying the Old Testament, the first time that we went back to California after being here for a few months, we had been going through Numbers, I think, and I told a friend who grew up in the church, he is a speaker at a congregation, knows the Bible, and I told him we had been going through Numbers, and he said, why do you spend so much time on the Old Testament? And it didn't make sense to him to really study the Old Testament. We're the New Testament church. And we had a discussion, and from studying that, you realize that the New Testament isn't new unless you study the Old Testament and you know why it's new. And things like going through Hebrews, I've learned so much more about Hebrews and thinking back to New Testament teachings that I grew up learning, but really going in depth into the Bible and studying the books of Moses in the Old Testament has really helped with that. And so that's sort of a broad
take. Great. And faith building. How could this be random authors over a millennium that somehow piece this together? It's ridiculous. The very idea that it could be done is ridiculous. Other comments before we go to 11? We're almost out of time here. Question number 5 or 6. Oh, here's a list of, if somebody wants this, I could email it to you, but it's a list of all the ways Moses and Jesus are comparable. And then finally, how would you describe the book of Deuteronomy? Final question of the Torah.
Well, I was going to say, you said one, I kind of answered it already. It's because, Moses is a huge part of Deuteronomy and the Torah. But the book is the easiest way I can explain is it's emotionally empowering. It's because you go through, it's informative, it's humbling, it's terrifying, it's wonderful, and the blessings, and it's all those things wrapped up in one. I was kind of looking at verses, and I saw Isaiah 11:2, and it says, the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. So that kind of made me think of not just Moses, but all the Israelites. That's what Moses was trying to impress upon the Israelites. You need to have the Spirit of wisdom and the fear of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
John? I think the book of Deuteronomy is a book of remembrance. I want to read a couple of scriptures from the book. In Deuteronomy 8:18 says, "You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day." Deuteronomy 5:15, "Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand by an outstretched arm." Deuteronomy 8:2, "You shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness." Deuteronomy 4:9-13, I'll summarize, essentially says, "Remember that God declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform." And Deuteronomy 9:7 says, "Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness." So if you put all these together, Israel was to remember God, to remember what God had done for them, bringing them out of Egypt, to remember how God provides for them, sustained them 40 years in the wilderness, to remember that they're in covenant with God, remember Horeb, and to remember that God punishes sin. And there are more examples where Moses tells them to remember something of significance. So these special reminders that are sort of sprinkled throughout the book of Deuteronomy, of course, had direct application to them, but can still be said today. A bad memory on our part to remember any of these things will often lead us to unfaithfulness. And so the book of Deuteronomy is a long book filled with lots of material, but to me, these key spiritual lessons stand out. Moses, at 120, is telling them to look back and to remember all these things, because if you forget any of them, you're in serious danger of apostasy.
Very good. I'll just dovetail off of that with mine. It's all about covenant, what I came up with. Chapters 1 through 4, remembering covenant history. 5 through 26, expounding covenant life. 27 through 30, urging covenant commitment. And 31 through 34, anticipating the covenant future. Same thing with us. We remember, the Bible expounds, we're urged to be committed, and then we anticipate the future return of Jesus Christ. Other comments before we close? Yes, Matt.
Just real quick, I'm going to say kind of the opposite of what Shahi said, not that I disagree with anything that he said, but I was thinking it's a book of promise. Think about where we are. Right now, we are getting ready to go into the promised land, and all of the entire book of Deuteronomy is Moses saying, you're going into this land, God is giving this to you, God will give you victory, and all you have to do is do what he tells you to do, and all of these incredible things will be given to you. So I think it's a book of promise along with the book of covenant and a book of remembrance, as we stated.
Very good. Excellent and great promises given to us by the Lord.